Well, hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Yes, Bob Berman is in the house. Our favorite astronomer is here. He is one of the most widely read astronomers in the world. He can translate scientific concepts that even a radio person can understand. It's quite amazing. And, of course, Bob has been featured in Discover Magazine, Astronomy Magazine. He's the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac. Your questions at 800-348-2551. Just don't ask him about the infinite universe. The whole show will spiral out of control very quickly. So no infinite universe unless you absolutely have to. 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be here, Ray.
So what's about this infinite universe?
Well, that's the thing that's really blowing my mind this year. I think every year there's always something. It was EPR or entangled particles a few years ago. The idea that, remember we talked about
one
that.
One thing across the universe.
Exactly. Instantaneously connects with another and the other responds in no time at all, even if they're separated by billions of light years. That a few years ago, I was trying to wrap my head around that. Now it's the new evidence that's come down from the Berkeley team just a couple of months ago that after studying 900,000 galaxies that the universe is infinite, or at least the space is flat.
Okay.
It shows no curves, and this strongly suggests an infinite universe. So nobody, it seems, not the New York Times, not the TV shows, not Morgan Freeman, nobody has picked that up and run with it and has gone to the next step, which is, okay, what does that mean? How does that change things? Because it changes everything.
But if, in fact, they have now modeled the universe to show shape, then how can it be infinite? This is what I don't understand.
Well, you don't understand it, and nobody can understand it because nobody can picture infinity. Although in the old days, meaning last year, we couldn't picture a universe that ended, because then what would be beyond that? Anyway,
right.
Everybody was saying, well, what is the universe expanding into? You know, that was the common question we'd get. But infinity, it means the galaxies really do go on and on, the way maybe our parents told us when we were little and we said, do the stars just go on and on?
Yeah.
And our parents who knew nothing would say, yes. They would make that up, but it turns out they were right.
But space could go on, and that doesn't mean there has to be stuff in it, right?
It does, because, well, it's an assumption, but we assume that the matter density of the universe is the same as what we see around us.
That's an assumption.
That the 0% of the universe that we observe is somehow representative, even though it's 0% of the whole thing, which means that the galaxy, we see galaxies and stars here, it means galaxies and stars continue
right.
on without end, that they go faster and faster the farther we look. It also means the Big Bang was seemingly just an event in the hood, just a local thing, a local disturbance. It wasn't the birth of any kind of universe. It was just the observable
universe.
Well, we're
5 minutes in, and I'm all ready to turn the lava lamp on. And by the way, Brian Shields just handed us, the National Weather Service has issued a tornado watch for much of the region until 8 o'clock tonight. A tornado watch means conditions are favorable for the formation of tornadoes. It is a watch. It is in effect until 8 o'clock for much of the region. And, of course, we will keep you posted with any weather updates that come down the pike. Now, we have a lot of calls already.
Good.
Shall we?
Sure.
Let's take off. Matt in Hillsdale. Matt, you're on.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey.
Two quick questions. I was wondering if you had a favorite or what you thought was the best resource to understand the moon cycle. I've looked a few times online, and I get lost or disinterested, but I am interested. And then the other question is there any, if at all, connection with an individual's astrological sign and the constellation that it's assigned to? And what's that association?
He loves these questions.
Okay, versus constellation. Just right, he's scribbling it down so I don't forget your second part.
Okay.
You said your first part. The moon cycle, fascinating. And I would say the only book that I know of, I don't even want to mention this because my publisher tells me I should be plugging the paperback version of the current book, The Sun's Heartbeat. I'm not mentioning 11 years ago, Secrets of the Night Sky, which is not even in print anymore. You'd have to find it on
eBay.
Amazon or
sure.
eBay.
Yeah, there you go.
But there, in that book, you talk about the moon cycles. Fascinating. You know, even Isaac Newton said that just thinking about the moon gave him a headache. because it does so many different things. I mean, we all know that it spins in the same rate that it goes around us. That is 27.32166 days. Okay, those are the same. But so do all 166 other moons in the solar system. They all spin in the same period around that they go around their planet. So that's not weird. But then the moon's orbit itself goes around us in an 8.86 year period. Plus, it's tilted, and that tilt processes around us. And so all these things are happening at once. And the moon's orbit is a little bit like a spirograph. They're all different periods. The moon comes closer each month, then goes farther away, and then comes closer again. And that period is 27.55455 days. And there's all sorts of periods of the moon. So can't get into it now.
Yeah.
Do that book. The other question, astrology versus constellations. You know, we usually astronomers stay away from astrology because none of us, you know, believe in it because the stats diss it or say that it doesn't exist. But suffice to say that in America and in Europe, astrology does not follow the actual constellations. For example, if you were born in late January, and you're supposed to be an Aquarius, according to astrology, the sun was actually in the constellation of Capricornus. So it's shifted over a little bit more than one constellation. In 1989, they shifted over a little bit more in that the winter solstice started happening not in Cancer. Remember, Tropic of Cancer was named for that. Shifted over to Gemini around the time of Christ. Then it shifted in 1989 into Taurus. So the real universe has the Earth's tilt changing and shifting. Astrology doesn't go with the flow and take into consideration those shifts. And so they use signs that don't follow the real constellations to answer your question.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Matt, thanks a lot. We appreciate it. We go to Alex in Amherst. Alex.
Hi, simple question. How do you deal with scientific inaccuracy that you encounter on, from my perspective, a daily basis? I encounter it. I just fear that I'm losing friends because I sit them down to two-hour-long lectures on subjects.
Well, again, yeah, you won't be making friends by lecturing to people for 2 hours. I've tried that. I've lost all my friends doing that. So just take my advice and don't do that. Of course, inaccuracies are bothersome. Some of the inaccuracies are just due to sort of rounding off because you always have to, if you're speaking or writing or on a radio show, you kind of have to give the general gist of things. So much is wrong. For example, we say the day is 24 hours. Well, it isn't because Earth spins in 23 hours and 56 minutes and 4.1 seconds. It's not 24 hours, but they keep saying that. But some of it, you know, how picky do you want to be? For example, we say the sun is rising. Well, we all know that what's happening is the horizon is falling.
Right.
But you'd sound pretty obnoxious and picky to say, oh, look at that. Look and watch the horizon fall. No, you know, it's language to say the sun is rising. So we go along with a lot of it. Some of it is downright wrong, though. I'll give one more example just to prove your point, how right you are. Haven't we all heard that people breathe out carbon dioxide? Right? Everybody says and every exhalation is carbon dioxide. But do you know that we actually exhale about 78% nitrogen? 17% oxygen, only 4% carbon dioxide, 1% argon. So when people say, yeah, people breathe out carbon dioxide, that's actually a tiny, tiny little percentage of what they breathe out. I mean, giving mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to someone who has collapsed, it would be pretty pointless if there wasn't a lot of oxygen in that offering,
right,
when we're breathing into their mouths. But you keep hearing in scientific circles that people breathe out carbon dioxide. So a lot of misinformation is out there. You're absolutely
okay.
Right.
All right. Well, I guess the upshot is, you know, try to keep it to yourself. That's all. Let's go to Dan in Hudson. Dan, how you doing?
Doing good. Doing good. Thanks for taking the call. We had a sighting. We don't usually see things like this, but we're on the 20th of June. We were on our top level, the porch, looking out at the night sky. And around 10:15, I'm just curious if any of your other listeners might call in, if anybody else saw something. We saw two, and they both followed the same pattern across the night sky, and they weren't at a very high elevation, perhaps maybe 1,000 feet at the most. A bright yellow star surrounded by what almost appeared as an energy or an aura of red that was finely outlined, and there was no body to it. It was just a light source that passed by us. I got the binoculars, and it was incredible. It passed, suddenly disappeared, and about 3-4 minutes later, a second one did the same, slowly going by, and did the same thing again, just simply disappeared. There was no body, no flashing lights. We know what other vehicles look like in the sky, but this was just strange.
Well, could you send some of that stuff here to the studio?
Yeah.
Which is send some.
Okay, no, no. You can't comment unless I was actually there. We get, as an observatory director, for some reason people call us once or twice a month. People assume observatories are UFO reporting stations, so we hear a lot of UFO reports, and sometimes we can actually answer them a lot of the time, but you know, some of the time I just have to say I would have had to be there,
seen
it myself, and seen, is it a bright planet, is it a little meteorological haze around it, is it a military aircraft?
No aircraft,
I tell you what, Dan, if anyone calls in and has that, you were in Hudson, and this was last week, you said?
No, this was the 20th of June.
Okay.
Right. My guess, if I had a guess, I would say it was just a routine UFO mothership.
Well, okay. Well, you know, it's funny. Observatories, they're focusing way out there. They wouldn't really be looking inside our atmosphere, would they?
Yeah, we're too myopic. We can't even see that close.
Exactly. 800-348-2551, the telephone number. We've got an open line, 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here now for your listening pleasure, The Theremin.
Support for Vox Pop comes from Rhinebeck Artists Shops, providing professional picture framing and art supplies in Rhinebeck and at their new expanded store at 188 Main Street at Mannheim in New Paltz. RhinebeckArt.com. Hudson Valley Footwear, Rhinebeck, New York. Footwear for the family, including Vibram Five Fingers, Sunita Clogs, and now it's Sandals. HudsonValleyShoes.com. The Cooperstown Summer Music Festival, presenting the Jupiter String Quartet, July 29th at 7:30 p.m. Performing works by Haydn, Bartok, and Mendelssohn. CooperstownMusicFest.org. And The Last of the Mohicans Outdoor Drama, Lake George, New York. Presenting drama and presentations celebrating local history, July 27th through August 18th. LastoftheMohicans.org for schedule.
Okay, we're back with Vox Pop. Bob Berman is here. This is exciting. 800-348-2551. We've covered the infinite universe. We've covered UFOs. We've covered people who can be annoying at cocktail parties, correcting everyone. Now we go back to the phones, and John in Newburg is here. John.
Yes, good afternoon. How are you?
Good.
Good. Here's I read an article recently, and I'd like Mr. Berman to maybe elaborate on it a little bit. And the article had to do with the dying of larger stars in a process called pair production, I think it was, where an antimatter was created, and it actually, the gist of the article was that the antimatter was created, so it lessened the density of the core of the star as it was dying. So if you can elaborate on that, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, antimatter production is actually a minor or non-existent factor in stellar evolution. Normally doesn't happen at all. What we see, however, in some parts of the universe are curious places where antimatter does exist. And I guess we should do an audience aside and explain that antimatter is the same as regular matter, except the electrical charges are reversed. For example, a electron is negatively charged, but an anti-electron, which is called a positron, that's what Data's brain was made of.
Yeah.
Would be positive. And so an atomic nucleus is normally, a proton is positive, but an antimatter proton would be negative. So that's the only difference between them. In the center of our galaxy, there's a fountain of antimatter, and we know it's there because it gives off a precise energy signature of 511,000 electron volts, and we know that these are positrons leaping up like Old Faithful from the center of the galaxy. And recently, just a year ago, November of last year, discovered the most astonishing, I think, astronomical discovery of the last 20 years. And that is, there's a twin bubble, like an hourglass, looks like the number 8, centered on the middle of the galaxy, made of gamma rays, whose origin seems to be antimatter. And these huge structures, 25,000 light years across, are centered on nothingness above and below the galactic plane, and they meet. The two bubbles just touch each other at the galactic plane. So what I'm saying is there's still lots of mysteries regarding the production of high energy and antimatter that's responsible for it, because when antimatter meets regular matter, they famously collide with a 100% translation of mass to energy. By comparison, a hydrogen bomb or the center of the sun only changes matter to energy with a 0.7%, 7/10 of 1% efficiency of matter to energy. Antimatter is 100%, so it's powerful stuff wherever we see
okay.
it.
Okay. Hey, John, we got to move on, but thank you very much. And we go to Maxine on Monroe. Maxine, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is about transits. We have the transit of Venus. And recently I was reading Arthur C. Clarke's Sands of Mars, and in it he mentioned about the transit of Earth. So if we were on Mars, would we see the Earth crossing the face of the sun like we see Venus crossing it now?
Yes, you definitely could. And you said it correctly, any planet outside of ours could see Earth streaming across the face of the sun, just as we see the two planets that are inward of us, Mercury and Venus, doing it. Interestingly enough, Mercury crosses the sun's face 13 times per century, and Venus crosses the sun's face 13 times per millennium. There's almost no rhyme or reason why that should be so, but that's the case. So 13 times per millennium is just barely more than once every 100 years, every century. So the one that we just had back on June 5th of this year, the last one that we're going to have until 2117, was quite an event. Yeah, if you were on Mars and you you caught it just right when the Earth, they'd be even rarer because Earth moves more slowly than Venus does, and our orbit is tilted relative to the Martian orbit. So the people on Mars would have to just catch it just where Earth is crossing from above to below the plane of the solar system, just as it's in inferior conjunction, passing in front of the sun. So it would be rare. I don't know in my mind how often a transit of Earth would happen for Martians. But
interesting question, though.
But they would happen.
So if you were on Saturn and you were looking past Jupiter toward the sun being smaller, Jupiter being huge, that might be a fairly large event.
Yes. Yes, exactly so.
Interesting. Wow. And is there any chance that any of these Mars rovers might take a gander if on the next Earth transit?
We'd have to find out when they have it. They might happen only once every few centuries.
Yeah.
So it would be a rare thing.
And we do have a new one coming up, a new Mars landing, right?
This weekend, the Curiosity lander, may be the most exciting of all.
Why?
Well, not only does it have sophisticated equipment and cameras and measuring equipment, but it's the first time ever that a human-made craft on the Martian surface will be measuring the radiation flux. And one of the things that we're very worried about in terms of sending people there is the high amount of radiation on Mars. Mars does hardly has an atmosphere. It's only 1% as thick as ours. Earth, our atmosphere is what blocks radiation, really. And then secondarily, our magnetic field also blocks radiation.
Mars has none?
Mars has no magnetic field at all and a very skimpy atmosphere. So all the cosmic rays and all the coronal mass ejections and material from the sun comes in full strength. And it's been estimated that astronauts on the Martian surface would get so much radiation that in a typical two-year mission, they'd lose up to 40% of their brain cells.
Yikes.
Would be destroyed.
Even with shielding?
No, well, the more shielding you have, the better it is. But if you're just going to stay under, 20 feet of Martian soil, it's like going to Hawaii and staying in the lobby.
All right, let's go to Jim in Amherst. Jim, you're on.
Yes, over in Adams, Massachusetts, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry. How are you, Jim?
Hey, Ray. How you doing?
Good.
All right. Asking Mr. Berman about his recommendation back for the transit of Venus on protective eyewear to view that event.
It's over, right?
Yes, it is. But would you recommend the same type of protective eyewear for that as for a solar eclipse as well?
Yes, absolutely. Shade. And I prefer welder's goggles because they're optically really good rather than the plasticky cheap ones that you might find on eBay. Go to any welding supply store, and there are two choices, shade number 14 or shade number 12. Both are adequate for the sun. They're perfect for the sun.
I have a problem with that recommendation. I happened to catch the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation program on WMC as it happens.
They were wrong.
The night before. They were wrong?
Yeah, they were wrong.
That professor was wrong?
He was wrong.
How so? Has someone actually tested these glasses and
absolutely. They've been tested. And in fact, at Astronomy Magazine, where I'm one of the editors and a longtime columnist, we had one of the great ophthalmological experts on astronomy and eye protection, and somebody whose name I've forgotten, but all the editors had an exact recommendation so that we could give it to our 80,000 subscribers, and he said that shade number 12 and shade number 14 are both perfectly adequate.
Interesting.
Well, his theory was that these welder's goggles were manufactured to shield out only the infrared spectrum of
wrong,
light
and not
the ultraviolet.
Wrong.
He was wrong there.
Absolutely wrong.
Gosh.
And there's a little bit of proof of that. I mean, just anecdotal proof.
Yeah.
I and the groups that I've been doing astronomy lectures for, going back to March 7th, 1970, have exclusively used shade number 12, stared at the sun for hours and hours, and my vision is still as good as,
yeah,
as it was.
You would not feel any burning sensation because you weren't getting the infrared, you were getting the ultraviolet exposure, overexposure, and you could damage your eyes without even knowing it.
Yeah, but you don't.
He was wrong.
Totally wrong.
And Jim, I should note that Bob does wear glasses. Just saying that.
And I can't see a thing. I'm as blind as
a bat. He's blind as a bat now.
All right, Jim,
good recommendation.
Thanks a lot. We appreciate the call. Let's go to Steve in Del Mar. Steve, you're on.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. So I have a question about telescopes for Mr. Burr. I figured he'd be able to answer them.
Oh, yes.
Okay. So, Mr. Berman, I have a nice 8-inch daub that I got recently, a GSO daub, and I love it. It came with a 2-inch lens and a 1.25. So the 2-inch lens, of course, is fantastic for looking at wide angle, any kind of nebula or any kind of star cluster. Beautiful through the 2-inch lens. You with me so far?
Yes.
Okay. So I also recently got from my dad, who didn't use it, a Teleview Pronto, which is just a 70 millimeter refractor. Are you familiar with those?
Yeah, sure, of course.
Okay, so what I want to know is that I can buy a 2-inch diagonal for that scope and then use my 2-inch lens on that scope. Would it be worth it?
I don't think it would be worth it because the focal length of the eyepiece and the quality of the eyepiece, I think it's more important as than the outside diameter of the eyepieces. Now, 2-inch diameter eyepieces are wonderful. The standard 1.25 work give you very, very wide fields. The only things that I recommend that people avoid are the old 0.965-inch outside diameter of the cheap refractors that can still be found. As long as it's 1.25 inches, the most important thing is the focal length and the quality of the eyepiece. You know, like Nagler and some of the other really great brands have fabulous wide fields. And as long as you have at least, I'd say, 20 millimeter in the focal length of the eyepiece, 25 millimeter, 30, 32 millimeter, that's what's going to give you the wide field more than the 2-inch versus 1.25 inch.
Interesting. Okay. So maybe not worth spending $100 on a decent 2-inch diagonal. Just keep what I got and work with it.
I think so.
Nice. All right. Good answer. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. We appreciate it. Vox Pop. Bob Berman is our guest. Bob's most recent book, The Sun's Heartbeat, is now out in paperback It is on Back Bay Books. It's called The Sun's Heartbeat, a great read, now in handy paperback form. Let's go to John in... Where are you calling from, John?
Hey, hi, guys.
Hey, where are you calling from?
I am from the town of Glen in Montgomery County.
Ah, Glen. Okay, got it. Thought it said Eileen, but all right, go ahead.
And my cat and I have very simple questions. Doesn't matter whether the universe is flat or infinite. On the energy that makes the planets spin, two questions. Where did that energy come from, and do the planets spin in the same direction, like clockwise, or some going clockwise and some anti or counterclockwise?
Okay, both questions. First, the energy that makes planets spin, you don't need any additional energy because since there's no friction in space, once you start spinning, you're going to spin forever. And the only thing that's going to change it is if some other object of torque is acting on it. For example, in the case of the Earth, we have the moon pulling on our tides, mostly the moon, also the sun, slowing us down and making our day 1/700th of a second longer each century, meaning at the end of a long lifespan, each day is 1/700th of a second longer, very slow. But that's because we have something acting on us. If you didn't have anything acting, you just keep spinning. You don't need any additional energy to keep spinning. As for the direction, all the planets spin counterclockwise if you're north of the solar system and looking down, if you're above the solar system, with two exceptions. And those are Venus, which barely spins at all. Venus is knocked totally upside down. So you can either think of it spinning the right way, but upside down, or the wrong way with the current axis up. But it almost doesn't spin. It's the object in the universe that's the most stationary. It takes 244 days to make a complete rotation, which means that you could walk along Venus's surface and keep the sun from setting. Not that you'd see the sun because it's overcast all the time, but you get the idea. Okay, and then also Uranus, which is on its side, and that's that has a wrong spin to it. All the others spin the right way.
Why does Venus spin the wrong way? Do we know?
It was probably hit once in its past. Although that's a little bit of a mystery because it's got the most circular orbit of every planet, and if it was really hit by something major, you'd think it would knock it out of its perfectly round orbit. So
maybe it knocked it into its perfectly round orbit.
What would be the chances?
Well, I don't know. You're the astronomer. Rodney in Agawam, you're up. Rodney.
Greetings, sir. I've read Stephen Hawking, and in his book, A Brief History, he talked about something called the Big Crunch. In other words, the Big Bang being the origin, the zero time point where the universe started, or perhaps from what you've been saying, our solar system and series of galaxies. But I also read an article about someone calling the cosmic bounce, in that they theorize that at some point, our universe, or what we claim to be our universe, will eventually start to contract rather than expand. And I was just curious, have you ever read or talked about these things? Were these theories kind of just not accepted, or are they also a part of what we're looking at in terms of the future of our universe?
It's a good question, and until the late 90s, that was a good possibility and a hope, which is that the expansion of the universe would someday come to a stop. The universe would recollapse to what you are calling a big crunch, and others have called the big crunch. And maybe there'd be a rebound somehow, and perhaps the universe breathes in and out. That was called the oscillating theory of the universe, and we thought maybe there'd be different laws of physics each time, like the old Hindu legend of the breaths of Brahma. Maybe every 80 billion years, new laws of physics, new possibilities, a new universe. It was aesthetically, I thought, very pleasing, certainly more so than a universe expanding forever and getting colder and more lonely. But ever since the discovery of what we now call dark energy, which is blowing the universe apart. The universe is exploding faster and faster. It started 6 billion years ago, and now we're just expanding at a faster and faster rate. There seems no hope whatsoever of the universe ever collapsing and coming back together into a big crunch and starting anew, unless there is something we don't understand about dark energy. And by the way, we don't understand anything about it. But maybe dark energy reverses itself over time and then becomes attractive. Who knows? But right now, it doesn't look like it could ever happen.
All right, Roddy.
I appreciate it, sir. Thanks
a lot. 1-800-348-2551, the telephone number. We have one open line at the moment. Let's get another call in before the break. We go to Kermit in Pittsfield. Kermit, go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. First, I want you to know, Ray,
yes,
that I could not get through during the fun drive when I had time, but you are my favorite. Nobody else. Not Dr. Shartok.
Oh, now cut it out.
No.
That's good.
You're very kind.
I'm making this public now.
All right.
I want to make sure I didn't get it in during the fun drive when most people listen.
Thank you very much. You know that Bob, there are a lot of listeners to Bob's show, so a lot of people just heard that.
I was going to say that. I'm sure that this Vox Pop, and when Dr. Berman shows up, it's the second most popular.
Right, but by this time, most people have glazed over. That's the problem.
Well, I have not.
All right,
so
good.
My question for the doctor this afternoon, and it seems that everybody is talking about Dr. Stephen Hawking, at least the prior caller. Recently, Dr. Hawking postulated that because of the results of the most recent experiments at the Hadron Collider, which he interpreted and explained as showing the Higgs-Bose particle or whatever, the God particle, that it came into existence in a total vacuum, that it just popped into existence. He therefore postulated that existence, our universe, and all of existence, simply popped into existence, which I found to be somewhat unscientific and unworthy of Dr. Hawking, but I don't have a degree in that area, and I will defer to the expertise of the guest, and I will simply hang up and listen. So I want to make sure that Dr. Berman understands the question. It's for a comment on what Dr. Hawking recently stated, and I think that He gave an address about it about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and there was a brief view of it given on either the Science Channel or Discovery Channel, one of the two, and that's when I listened to his lecture on it. So my comment is to ask you about his opinion that the universe simply popped into existence based upon the most recent experiment at the Hadron Collider and do you agree or disagree?
All right,
gentlemen.
Kermit,
yes.
Thank you very much. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll give Bob a few extra minutes to figure that out. And then we'll answer that question. It's Vox Pop on WAMC.
Support for Vox Pop comes from Dam Cafe and Deli, Saugerties, New York, serving breakfast and lunch with chef-created soups, salads, vegetarian options, and homemade desserts. Catering services available. TheDamCafeAndDeli.com. Harlow Luggage, Northampton, Massachusetts, featuring Briggs & Riley and Eagle Creek Luggage, handbags by Bagolini, leather goods, silver jewelry, and gifts and accessories by Brighton. Online, shopharlows.com. The Cove Festival of Performance, Amherst, Massachusetts, presenting a season of original theater curated on the themes of age, aging, and ageism on the Amherst College campus. KOFEST.com. And the Brattleboro Retreat, featuring its newly remodeled psychiatric inpatient program for children ages 6 to 12. BrattleboroRetreat.org.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, our guest, his new book, The Sun's Heartbeat, out in paperback now on Back Bay Books. And Kermit, before we took the break, said, all right, what about Stephen Hawking and his comments recently that we just popped into existence? I know from doing this show that Bob has occasionally taken exception to some things that Professor Hawking has said. What do you think about that one?
Yeah, I don't know where Stephen Hawking is in these last few years of his life. He may just be getting crankier, or I don't know what's happening. The true reading of the results or the Higgs boson or anything, and what we know about cosmology in the universe is we have so little data, hard data, cosmologically speaking, about the early days of the universe. We think that 380,000 years after the Big Bang, the cosmic microwave background started, but there's almost nothing that's sure. And we really don't know. And an honest answer is we don't know. And so far as saying that the universe just think of that word, just popped into existence. Is this really an explanation? Does this really shed light? Would any seven-year-old, if they said, how did the universe begin? You said, it just popped into existence. Is that an answer? Wouldn't somebody say, well, yeah, but how? I mean, you don't get something for nothing. What preceded it? What was the matrix like before it popped into existence? And so this is no answer. This is no information.
But is it not speculation? Isn't that part of the fun of science? You throw something out there and you see if it sticks. You do some tests and you...
It's true, but then you must also say that we have so little information right now that we honestly don't know. My guess would be that it popped into existence, although that doesn't really explain anything. That would be an honest statement.
Okay, fair enough. Let's go. I hope that satisfies Kermit. Let's go to Peter in Springfield. Peter, you're on.
Yeah, hi, Ray.
Hey.
Good afternoon, Dr. Berman. I've got a theory more than a question, but I'm going to bring things back to Earth here. Instead of imagining the Earth as a big blue marble, let's imagine it as a battery. Could we build a tower on the North Pole, one on the South Pole, run some cables to the equator, and get an infinite source of electricity? I'll take your answer offline, but before I do, I want to say to you both, may the force be with you, and live long and prosper.
Nanu, nanu, my friend. Thank you. All right. What do you think, Bob?
Well, I'm wondering if what he means is that using Earth's inertia, in other words, our inertial mass, the fact that we're spinning as a generator, as a turbine, as a source of power. And I suppose there might be some way to do it, but the problem always is, would that be cheaper than, let's say, watching water run over a dam and turning turbines, or would it be far more costly? And I suspect that just from the way that works, just because it sounds free because the Earth is turning, that by the time you did any kind of a structure, and how would you anchor that structure anyway? Because anything that's anchored is at the different spots. So it doesn't sound, I mean, I'm no technological person. I want to address something since the last several callers have said, Dr. Berman.
Yeah.
My friend who's a dentist, Bruce Milner, after shows like this, he'll call me Dr. Berman sarcastically for the next several days that I see him.
Well,
I actually dropped out just before getting my doctorate, and but I'll take an honorary doctorate
right.
if anybody wants to give it. But I thought I'd
all right, fair enough. That. So we'll just call you professor, or shall we just call you Bob?
I was actually a professor for 4 years.
All right.
I taught college astronomy.
We'll just call you Star Dude. Let's go to Brent in Albany. Brent.
Hey, how's it going, Bob?
Good. Bob, that's good. That's the best.
You're on, man. Hello? Bad connection? We'll give him a second here. Are you still there, Brent? Oh, your cell connection's very bad, my friend. Try it again. You know, here's a question that you may or may not be able to answer. We watched a show on the Earth's core the other day at my house, and I was surprised to learn that there was a layer of iridium all the way around the Earth. And that's space metal, right? Or space material?
Yes.
So suggesting that something crashed into us at one point,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Okay. So my question was about the rare Earths. Allegedly, China has a monopoly on them to some extent. Rare Earths are also star stuff, right?
Well, some aren't. Like praseodymium, for example, is very rare, but it's terrestrial. Iridium and osmium are found more in asteroids than they are on Earth. So when we get impacts from meteorites, they are far richer than what we'd see here. So if we see a worldwide deposition layer, just like we see at the boundary between the Cretaceous and Tertiary periods, this KT layer, a very thin layer, very rich in iridium, that really indicates that some celestial object came in, blew up, hit the Earth, created a lot of dust, and that dust settled all around the Earth at that one specific time. It's really, really a good fingerprint.
I'm sure I have it wrong, but my question was basically at that time, why does China have a monopoly on so much of the rare earths? Why isn't it more uniformly spread out?
I think that just happens because of continental drift. I think land masses moving redistribute what was at one time probably more uniform. This is a little outside my field.
Yeah, exactly. But, all right. I'm sorry I got off topic. I just thought I would throw it.
No, it's cool. It's very...
Bill in Hurley. Bill, you're up.
Thank you. I'm your neighbor, Bob.
Oh, hi.
Hi, how are you? Different dentist, though. I'm reading Stephen Hawking. Here we go again with Stephen Hawking. I'm reading The Grand Design right now. And the other day I noticed on NPR you made a comment that Stephen Hawking was completely in the dark based on the fact that we don't have enough data to really support a lot of these assumptions. And in the first chapter, Stephen Hawking mentions that based on the laws of physics, there would be no need for any creator or anything outside of the laws of physics to create such a universe. That's my first question, if you could just give me your thought on that. And the second, is it true that at the center of our galaxy, there is a black hole that perhaps could be causing the particular shape and some of the characteristics of our universe?
Center of the universe. Well, there is no, center to the universe.
Oh, it's the center to our galaxy.
Right. There is a black hole in the center of the galaxy with a mass of 4 million solar masses that's located there, almost lightweight for a supermassive black hole in that category. But we found supermassive black holes in the center of every galaxy that's been probed. So perhaps supermassive black holes were the seeds that started galaxies being galaxies in the first place, including ours.
Because they pulled matter into its influence, basically, in a spiral pattern of sorts.
That they were the glue that perhaps started things going.
Okay.
Okay, and now the question of outside the realm of physics, could there be any laws that could be subscribed to a creator? Because Stephen Hawking says that he doesn't believe that, and that human beings are nothing more than biological machines with no free will.
This is his bias. Now, there are astronomers. Carl Sagan was one who was a humanist. He was a wonderful person. He was an atheist. Stephen Hawking, although originally a Catholic, has also been an avowed atheist, and that's his bias. Now, if he looks around the universe and sees no sign of a creator or a higher power, that's what he sees. There are others who would say that means you're blind, that everywhere you look, you would see magic and intelligence behind it. That issue of what lies beyond this universe is one that I've always tried to avoid on these shows, because even though I'd love to use this microphone as a platform to tell the world what the true wisdom is according to the universe, I'm actually here not I've been given this microphone to do astronomy, so I tend to avoid that. But I'd say he definitely has a bias. It's not based on anything that I could support. Whether you believe in a creator, believe in God, or don't believe in God, there is no scientific evidence that could possibly point you in that direction or prove it. So all he's doing is giving his own, he's using his renown as a platform.
Okay.
And I think that's actually a little bit unethical on his part, frankly, to either use it for promoting religion or for promoting atheism. I think that's not the place of it, especially because you can't prove either one way or the other.
Bill, thanks a lot. We appreciate it. We'll go to Mel in Willow. Mel.
Oh, hello. May I call you Bob?
Oh, yes, please. I'm going to regret that.
Yes, you are, doctor. Go ahead.
Well, I was intrigued by a comment you made in passing earlier in this program concerning EPR and the possibility of, the possibility of communicating, presumably intelligent races communicating across billions and billions of light years. Do I have that correct?
You have that half correct. EPR correlations, named after Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, three physicists who in the 30s said that the quantum mechanical theory of that if waves collapse and if two objects were born together so that they both share a wave function, well, then one object would know that the other's wave function collapsed and would instantly mimic it. In other words, if an electron, which only exists in a probabilistic state, is observed so that it collapses to be an actual object in an actual position, its twin, even if it's located billions of light years away, instantly knows that it was measured, knows that it became an actual electron with a certain property, let's say an up spin, and it will collapse to do the same thing, or actually have complementary particle properties, in this case a down spin. If one is polarized horizontally, the other one will be polarized vertically. This happens instantaneously, and all the experiments we've done show that this wild stuff is really true. The only thing that you said that I would correct is that we cannot use this to send information or communications because these events are always random. When one collapses, it will collapse in a random way, and so will its entangled twin. So we can't guide it or force it to act in a certain way to send information to the other.
Okay, Mel, thanks a lot. By the way, I wanted to remind everybody, the National Weather Service has issued a tornado watch for much of the region until 8 o'clock tonight. Tornado watch means conditions are favorable for the formation of tornadoes. It's not a warning. We're just letting you know there is a tornado watch put up by the National Weather Service until 8 o'clock tonight for much of the region. Bob Berman is our guest, and we have time for a couple of more calls here. Jeff in Westerlo. Jeff, you're on.
Thank you. There's measurements for everything that we've, you know, I mean, I hear measurements from the time I get up in the morning from the weather. The measurements you guys have are so accurate. And all of a sudden, I heard a guy from RPI, a physicist, talk about something called a HERM. He called it, I don't know if you heard about this, but it's a human energy renewable measurement. And he based it on joules, and it's based on intellect and physical labor.
I don't know.
Now, that's outside my field. I don't know anything about
that. Oh, okay. Well, I wonder, you know what? Thanks, Jeff. Why don't you email me on that? That sounds interesting. Let's go to Jim in Albany. Jim.
Hey, hello, Ray and Bob.
Hi.
You know, this is not the first radio program, Bob and Ray.
No, it's true.
Well, that was a great one. I was a big fan of Bob and Ray.
Me too.
Hey, I was wondering about, I know that one of the Dutch philosophers called Newton a magician because he believed in an invisible force between the sun and the planets. And I was wondering what the latest ideas are. For example, do you have any ideas, Bob, about this gravitational force, which we can't see, but which somehow acts at tremendous distances between, for example, the sun and the earth?
Now, you're asking about gravity specifically?
Yeah, we call it gravity. It's really not a good word because it's a universal force, whereas gravity is more of a terrestrial force in terms of the name word itself. It has origins.
It's a shame you called with 2 minutes left.
Yes.
Oh.
But that's okay. Let's see what we can do here with a minute or two.
Okay.
And if I'm understanding you correctly, I'm not sure I am, you're asking about gravity and its other aspects? In other words, is it really a form of geometry? As Einstein said, is gravity really the result of space warping and so space-time warping?
Well, actually, Bob, I asked about your thoughts because I like the title of your book, The Sun's Heartbeat. I'm going to try to pick it up, and sounds like an interesting book.
Oh, it's my favorite. I think you'll like it a lot.
When
you mentioned the sun, a previous caller went over whether shade 12 welder's goggles is as safe as shade 14, and I want to say that if you use either for
Bob,
the sun...
Bob, did you discuss gravitation in your book? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I do discuss it, but I cannot give it any kind of real treatment in the 1.5 minutes.
Do you feel we have advanced over the Dutch philosopher who said Newton was a magician?
In other words, do we still know anything about it?
Have we got any rational explanations for how this force works?
That's a great question.
Ultimately, it's mysterious. Of the four forces of the universe, there's four forces in the universe. Gravity is the most mysterious of
the four. Why don't they get that across in the schools better than they do, the fact that there are great mysteries about the universe?
That's the fun of the universe. Jim, we're out of time, my friend, and that's a great way to end it. I always thought it was sort of, you know, like a big thing. If you put it on a sheet, it made a rut,
yes.
And it's like a warp of everything.
That's right. I do want to just finish that sentence. If you're looking at the sun, shade 12 or 14 are equally safe.
Okay.
But one will give a slightly brighter sun's image. I prefer 12. 14 will make it a little dimmer. Both will protect you against ultraviolet and infrared equally well.
Bob Berman, a lot of fun. The Sun's Heartbeat out on paperback now, and it is on Back Bay Books. We'll see you next time. Support comes from Hudson Valley Mold Remediation, providing mold inspection and removal to homeowners and businesses in Ulster, Sullivan, Green, Orange, and Rockland counties. HVMoldRemediation.com. John G. Ullman and Associates in historic downtown Rhinebeck and Corning, providing individuals, families, and nonprofits with financial management, planning, investment, and tax services, jgua.com. And Sunflower Natural Foods Market, Woodstock, New York, local organic corn on the cob, seedless watermelon, vegetarian and vegan hot dogs and burgers for summer, sunflowernatural.com. That's it. Thanks to Zach Malloy at the controls. Melissa Bunning answered our calls. Our producer, Patrick Donjes. Tomorrow, it's Moyers & Company. Next week, Medical Monday at this time. I'm Ray Graff. Have a great weekend. Stay tuned now for a news update.